Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz today.
This isn't going to make for great reading this morning in the Oval Office, is it? Bidenomics equals inflation. That is not what Bidenomics, the narrative, was supposed to land with.
Well, that's not what it represents. And look, I understand this is your poll. You're going to promote it. But I think overall, there's been lots of evidence that people are starting to appreciate more of the positive things in this economy.
Let me say for the record that it is very clear that no one thinks the economy is in a good place. No one thinks the economy is doing all right. Nobody thinks that things are good, and nobody thinks that Bidenomics has saved us. No one believes this. Tony Katz today. Good to be with you. Find everything at TonyKatz.com. Sorry about my little microphone issue. It wasn't your radio. It wasn't the Russians. It was me on this one. The Dow is down 546. The NASDAQ is down 219. Because the GDP did something terrible to the bed. Something absolutely terrible and awful to the bed. They did the kind of thing to the bed that they claimed Donald Trump did to the bed, except they didn't claim Donald Trump did this to the bed. Because if he had done this to the bed, that would have been an even more salacious story that wasn't true. But this story is true, and the moral of the story is you might have to throw out the bed. 1.6% GDP, gross domestic product. The expectation was 2.4. Things are not good. Yet the administration still wants to tell us how things are good. We're going to break down all of this, especially this call for a 44.6% capital gains tax. It is surreal. Meanwhile, you're seeing little bits of the the Hamas support dripping and drabbing all over the place. You've got University of Texas Austin, where the arrests were plentiful because Texas police are not screwing around. You've got the continued actions at NYU and Columbia. This took place at Purdue University in my beloved Indiana.
And mothers in Palestine.
What we intend to do is establish
So this is the presidential lecture series. Senator Todd Young is speaking. He's got the president of Purdue University on stage with him. And here is this protester screaming and yelling because, you know, she supports Hamas. I want to make sure that I am clear. We shouldn't have any daylight between us. There is no such thing as somebody who is pro-Palestinian. What they are is pro-Hamas. I don't care what they say. I received the strangest argument I thought I could ever find. And of course, it came from social media. I apologize to no one for noticing things, for speaking honestly, for speaking clearly. I have nothing to apologize for at all. And you should never apologize for being honest and being clear. Oh God, I was going to show it to you, and then they blocked me. That's hilarious. What is the rule if someone blocks you on utilizing their name when you're a radio host? Producer Carl, what is the rule there? Do you do it? I can give it to you, and then you can look it up.
Yeah,
I can
give
that,
it to
right?
me.
Yeah, I'll send it to you. Their argument was that When have college students ever been wrong? You take a look at Vietnam. You take a look at women's rights. When have college students ever been wrong? 20-year-olds screaming for the elimination of a nation on a college campus is how we determine policy in the United States? That is a radical thought. An absolutely radical thought. And by the way, blocking me, super weak. You brought the argument. I came back. You blocked me. It's weak. It is what it is. But hey, it's social media. You do what you want. You've got all the power. I've been silenced or something. What an odd reaction and response. There's a lot of these. But I don't want us to forget what's going on. And the reason this matters is because that word manipulation is being utilized against all of us on a daily basis. And it's important to recognize. There is no such thing as pro-Palestinian. There is pro-Hamas. Because the Palestinian has no say. The Palestinian is the one living in all sorts of hell, except, of course, for those Palestinians in poll after poll who support Hamas, would vote for Hamas again and approve of the October 7th attack that murdered 1,200 and also involved the rape of women and killing of babies. Poll after poll after poll. If the Ukrainians aren't great people, can we be clear that the quote-unquote Palestinians might also not be great people? But there are some who don't want to live in this hellscape. But they have to deal with Hamas, a terrorist organization sponsored by Iran that would gladly kill them if they should speak out. The people at the campus of Columbia University are pro-Hamas. This child protesting at Purdue University. It's just one. I don't know if that means it's the start of something. Because you had like a group of people trying to block traffic on one of the main roads in Indianapolis earlier today. The first time we've seen that since the Black Lives Matter insanity. Then it was just pulling guns on motorists. They pulled guns on motorists and then got angry because people like me noticed. True story. The Black Lives Matter people are like, how dare you post that? It was a news story. I posted the news story. How dare you point a gun at somebody? Well, we have the right. Super. This is going great. These people are pro-Hamas. Start there, and then we can work our way up and through a multiplicity of these arguments. At Princeton University, they started an encampment. Then it got announced, you'll all be arrested, and the encampment ended. At Columbia, they started an encampment. The police came through, tore it all down. They put it all back. And when you ask, how did they put it all back? That's when you realize, of course, they're funded. Somebody is funding this operation. Now, many people are like, well, that's George Soros at work. This brings up a very interesting conversation about George Soros and a group called Odyssey, which is a radio group. Which has engaged Chapter 11 bankruptcy. It happens, right? People reorganize all the time. It doesn't mean the end of the world. But supposedly, one of Soros' funds has bought into the group in a big way. I've talked about this story before. Well, if you're able to tie Soros to what's going on in college campuses, and Soros now owning a media company, that's going to be a lot of concern for a lot of people. That's going to send off a fair amount of red flags for a lot of people. But I bring that up because it has come up that, you know, these groups are funded and why certain names keep coming back and how they're connected to other things. But University of Texas, Austin, oh, they arrested lots of people. And these students were apoplectic. Who do you think you are and how dare you? Which brings us to Representative Ocasio-Cortez. Representative Ocasio-Cortez is angry with the police. And angry with Columbia University for involving the police on the students. Not only did Columbia make the horrific decision to mobilize NYPD on their own students, but the units called in have some of the most violent reputations on the force. NYPD had promised the city they wouldn't deploy SRG to protests. So why are there counterterror units here? Well, you mean why do police show up in force? It's a question I've asked very, very often. You didn't seem to ask that question when they showed up to Paul Manafort's house. The NYPD chief of patrol responds, "Truly amazing," he writes to Ocasio-Cortez. "Columbia decided to hold its students accountable to the laws of the school. They are seeing the consequences of the actions. Sometimes these kids were most likely never taught. Good SAT scores and self-entitlement do not supersede the law. I am sure you would agree that we have to teach them these valuable life skills." Oh, my. That's just terrific. "Secondly, I was with those units last Thursday that you describe as having the most violent reputations. These units removed students with great care and professionalism. Not a single incident was reported." It continues, "You should rethink your comments to a simple thank you to the NYPD, and hate has no place in our society. Maybe you should walk around Columbia and NYU and listen to their remarks of pure hatred. I will ensure those units will protect you as they do for all New Yorkers 24/7, 365. The pro-Hamas radicals have the support of members of Congress who excoriate the universities for calling the police. That's where we're at. So when we discuss people like Representative Ocasio-Cortez or Representative Ilhan Omar, who spoke at one of these events, or Representative Tlaib as un-American, well, certainly you cannot describe them as pro-American, because they are not taking a side that would involve safety, security, or rational dialogue. They're taking the side of people who support terrorists and support the idea that a college campus could be a place that stops people from walking across the campus and screams for the killing of a specific group. But if that group were black people or that group were gay people, well, then they would be outraged. But they're not outraged. They want to have separate rules. Un-American. Anti-American. Rules for this group, rules for that group, no groups, no rules for this group. You know why I oppose hate crimes? This is exactly why. You know why I oppose these whole subset kind of conversation? This is exactly why. And this is the way these people act. So, I have got a series of things still to break down on this. But I spent 2 hours listening to the Trump SCOTUS case. It is very, very deep. William Jacobson, Cornell Law professor, is going to be with us, scheduled to be with us to break this down. I will have that. But we need to properly utilize language when dealing with these violent rioters. I'm sorry, violent jackals. No, what do I call, what, I don't know what to call these people. I will call them protesters, but always violent. But they're not protesting. They are calling for people's death. They are stopping people from engaging in an education that they paid for. There are Title VI violations up and down the line. They are supported, these pro-Hamas horrific tools. They are supported by members of Congress who are fine with Americans getting killed, damaged, or destroyed as long as they're Jews. But they're not ending there. And this is what we know. This is what we have been talking about. And they let the cat out of the bag repeatedly. This isn't about Israel. This is about America. And those college students, being misled, they're right, by elected officials and by professors who are thrilled with what's happening because they still get paid no matter what. I'm Tony Katz. Dangerous. versus AI? It's try to frame the principle dangerous. Tony Katz. Tony Katz today. The story is out of Baltimore County. And the story goes that there was an audio recording of the principal, guy by the name of Eric Eiswirt. The audio recording then got circulated around social media. In the recording, the principal is making racist comments and anti-Semitic comments. I mean, it's just despicable stuff. Got circulated everywhere. People are like, what is this? Who does he think he is? What's happening here? The principal's like, yeah, wasn't me. You can hear the song in the background. Wasn't me. But there's your voice. There's the recording. People went nutty. Other people are like, guys, this is not real. Turns out it wasn't real. The former athletic director, Dejan Darian, was charged with disrupting school activities after investigators determined that this guy faked the principal's voice and circulated the audio on social media. Utilizing AI, he manipulated the guy's voice, made him sound like he was saying these things, and tried to destroy him. I can remember being at one of the first conferences in San Francisco about video blogging, vlogging, as it was really called in the day. This is 2006. This is a while ago. But I remember it because there was a guy there. I don't want to use names. I don't think it would hurt. There's a guy there by the name of Eric. And he was having a conversation about the idea of identity theft. And his point was that identity theft is not the real thing to be concerned with. Remember, this was near 20 years ago. The thing to be concerned with is what happens when someone steals your face, your voice, your reputation. Identity theft is nothing. Reputation theft. How do you come back from that one? I remember the conversation. I was standing outside of a weird looking bar, or a conference hall kind of, super weird. I remember it as clear as day. And he was right. And now we live in it. This is only the beginning. Utilizing AI to try and damage other people for jobs, for power, political purposes. Check, double check, and recheck everything. Everything that you see and everything that you hear. And you're like, man, that's exhausting. I'd rather just turn it all off. I mean, that's the way it's going to go, right? People are just going to be like, ah, forget it. Then what are you listening to? Where are you gathering information? And we're trusting what's being read? What you're reading? Well, that's being written by AI too. It's not that I oppose the concepts of AI. It's that the ugly is very real. Oh, it's scary. Scary and dangerous. And I wonder whether or not we're going to see cities or municipalities, states, put much larger punishments on the utilization of AI in this way to try and discourage people from going down this road. Meanwhile, Trump's case was heard in front of the Supreme Court. What did they have to say? William Jacobson, Cornell Law Professor, is here to break it down with us. That's up next. I'm Tony Katz.
It is correct, Justice Alito, but I think that we should also consider the history of this country. As members of the court have observed, it's baked into the Constitution that any president knows that they are exposed to potential criminal prosecution. My friend says after impeachment and conviction, we don't read the impeachment judgment clause that way, but it's common ground that all former presidents have known that they could be indicted and convicted. And Watergate cemented that understanding. The Watergate smoking gun tape involved President Nixon and H.R. Haldeman talking about and then deciding to use the CIA to give a bogus story to the FBI to shut down a criminal investigation.
There was a lot of mentions of Nixon in the conversation in front of the Supreme Court. The voice you heard was that of Michael Dreeben, Justice Department counselor to special counsel, arguing in front of the Supreme Court that, yes, indeed, President Trump should be able to be charged criminally, that he should be able to be charged with a crime if he committed a crime. On the other side was the argument that you can't charge a president with acts that are, well, engaged in the job of the presidency. And the court was seemingly to me asking a whole lot of questions that didn't leave me thinking they were specific in any one direction. Tony Katz, great to be with you. Tony Katz today. William Jacobson joins us right now, Cornell Law professor from LegalInsurrection.com. How I saw it as a layman is different than how somebody could see it in the legal. But first, in the legal profession, let's break down what I said here about what this case is. This case is about whether or not a president in the job of doing the president can be charged with a crime. Is that correct?
That is correct. The question that they took this case on was, and I'm reading it now, is whether and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office? This case regards official conduct of the president. The argument's still going on. I don't know if I recall a longer argument where there weren't multiple parts, but it's still going on. But there's been a lot of discussion about private versus public. The issue, the legal issue on which the court took the case, assumes that a president is charged for official acts, and that is the question they are considering.
So it's interesting, the idea of official acts, because in the conversation with Trump's lawyer, one of the things that they asked is, is it an official act if it benefits him? If it benefits not necessarily Trump, but any president, is it always an official act, even if the benefit comes to him directly? And I thought that was an interesting question, because I could not figure out if they're trying to understand the scope of Trump's team, or they're trying to figure out how they would draw the line on what is and isn't. And I couldn't figure out how they were going to draw that line. What did you take from that?
Yeah, I don't think they will draw the line in this opinion. I think they will simply find, in response to their question, that there is presidential immunity for official acts well done in office, and send it back down to the district court to opine on whether the charges in this case involve official acts or not. And I think the more interesting question is, what if it's a combination? And I don't know if they will opine on that or reserve that for another day. And that, I think, is really the dilemma in this case, is that it's a mix of potentially official and potentially private acts that are alleged. And during the questioning, I forget which justice it was, I think it might have been Barrett. Well, what about this allegation? Is that public or private? Or what about that allegation? So I think that's going to be the tougher question. Is what are you going to do where it's a mix of public and private acts? I'm sorry, official and private acts. And that, I don't know if they'll decide that now.
So that was indeed, your memory is solid, talking to William Jacobson, Cornell Law professor, the mind behind LegalInsurrection.com. That was Trump's lawyer. Sauer is his name, S-A-U-E-R. ER. And he was speaking to Amy Coney Barrett, Justice Barrett, John Sauer is his name. And she asked, so you concede that private acts don't get immunity? To which Sauer responded, we do. And then Barrett went to pages 46 and 47 of the brief that Sauer filed and just started going down the list. And it was a moment of, well, now it really gets tricky because we're making the argument that there can be a private act, but who would get to decide the private act? And that's the part where I lost my head. I'm like, how? I have always looked at this case and said, I don't know how the Supreme Court is going to say that someone can't be charged. But I had not considered that there would be a differential to the idea of a private act and a public act. Were you able to determine in listening to the case being argued what they thought was a private act and a public act?
No. I mean, some things, you know, I don't think so. And that's why I don't think the court's going to rule on it. I don't think the court's going to go through the indictment line by line and say this is public and can be charged. I'm not public. I keep saying public. This is official and can be charged, and this is private and can be charged. So I don't think the court's going to do that. I think it's going to announce a rule that the president has immunity for official acts and then let the lower courts decide and rule based on evidence presented to them what is official and what is not.
So in your view, what does this do to the Jack Smith case specifically on January 6th?
Assuming the ruling is, as I've just articulated, it means it's certainly not going to trial before the election because that whole process is going to take time. I have no doubt Chutkan will rule on it fairly quickly, but then it goes up on appeal and possibly back to the Supreme Court. And while that's all going on, even if that process were somehow miraculously to be concluded in a month or two, which I think is unlikely, it's still too late to get a trial done before November.
Let me go to the other side of this case. Something that I thought was really interesting was from the Justice Department, the lawyer, the solicitor there, Dreeben. And he was asked by, I think it was Justice Alito, whether or not in the Justice Department's view of this, what if the president makes a mistake? If we take a look at what the Justice Department wants to do in bringing charges, if the president gets bad advice, if the president makes a mistake, if the president sees something one way and it actually turns out to be the other way, well, then he's guilty of a crime, correct? Like you could then go after him, correct? And it seems that the Justice Department was saying, well, look, he has the Attorney General. He has all the counsel that he needs. It's really up to him. They're making the argument that the Trump team is making, I argue, is very difficult. But it seems like the Justice Department was actually trying to say, yeah, it's on the president, and any president can be charged any time for any bad policy or any mistake based on evidence presented that doesn't work out well.
I mean, that's the problem here. Once you loosen the rule about presidential immunity, then there's no end to it. And that's what I think the fear is. I think the question is, how far beyond, or are they even going to discuss at this point, what is an official act? Because I forget the term that they use, but the Trump team has a fairly expansive term. It's not just the official act, but it's everything surrounding it. And that would, of course, expand it dramatically. And so they want to say, you know, anything that the president does that is even tangential to an official act. And again, I'm not thinking off the top of my head of the word they use, but anything that's even tangential is covered by immunity. I don't know if the Supreme Court will get into that, you know, how far beyond. I mean, there are things that are clearly an official act of the president, you know, signing a bill, signing an executive order, things like that. But what about things that get into the political sphere that surround what the president does in an official capacity? I don't know if they will get into that. or if they will allow the lower courts to sort that out. But that's real, where I think the real nub is. I mean, I don't think even the government here says that Trump could be, you know, indicted for a presidential proclamation or something like that. Although maybe I'm wrong on that, you know, if it was a presidential proclamation to do something illegal, they might say he can be prosecuted. So this is a messy situation. I think we'll get a pronouncement of law and they'll send it back down and say, come back in a year or two.
Talking to William Jacobson, Cornell Law Professor, LegalInsurrection.com. Let me move it off the Trump case really quick and move it on to college campuses as you follow these things and talk about these things, write about these things extensively, what you're dealing with at Cornell, what's happening at Columbia and NYU. I am hearing that in my own beloved Indiana, Indiana University now has an encampment. You've seen the arrests there at University of Texas, Austin. And there are some people on the political right who are arguing you cannot arrest somebody for anti-Semitism, that somehow it is wrong for colleges to call in authorities to engage arrests. I have to tell you, I'm stunned by this type of theory, because that's not why these people are being arrested. Although, if you're preventing somebody from walking down the street and you're targeting people because they're Jews, based on what the country describes as hate crimes, that could be allowed, correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, nobody is being arrested or moved off campus because they're vile, disgusting people, okay? They're being moved off campus because they violated the campus rules against camping on, you know, university property. They don't allow encampments on university property. They don't allow taking over of, you know, areas of campus. They don't allow a lot of things regardless of what your viewpoint is. And so if somebody could come to me and say they allow groups they agree with to set up tent cities on campus, but they're not allowing these people, then you might have a free speech sort of argument. But that's not it. I believe these protesters very strategically at a centralized level of the groups that are coordinating this nationally have found that this is a really good tactic, because you set up an encampment, you know it violates the rules at almost every university, maybe every university, and therefore, you know you are going to be challenged. You know you're going to create a confrontation. You're going to create a confrontation outdoors where everybody can see it and video it. And then you get to play victim. And you get to make the stupid arguments such as the ones you're quoting other people are making about free speech, when in fact it's the encampment that's the problem. Or you get the university to back down and you proclaim victory. So this is a very typical, quote unquote, pro-Palestinian type of tactic. And we see it in Israel as well. They do something that they have a win-win situation. They win if there's a confrontation and they lose, and they win if they win. So that is what is going on here. This is very strategic. It's all nonsense. There are many photographs of some of these tent cities, not all of them, but many of them. I put one on my website last night from a local newspaper where the tents are identical. Somebody went out and put in an order for a bunch of tents. It wasn't the students who showed up. These are, in many cases, not students bringing the tents they slept in last summer in the national park. Somebody is coordinating this, and they have decided that tent cities is the object that they want to be the focus of these protests for the reasons that I have articulated. They also, and no one's really picked up on this, they also call these, you know, liberated areas, things like that. Well, liberated from what? Who is it liberated from? Well, it's liberated from the United States. This is a reflection that this movement does not recognize the sovereignty of the United States. And they say this. A lot of them, and I see it at Cornell in particular, they call the United States, they call our country Turtle Island. Turtle Island is the term that some Native Americans use to the creation of the earth. So this is very much a Khmer Rouge year zero sort of movement. They do not recognize the United States. They want our system torn down. They want to start over with Turtle Island or year zero, whatever they want to call it. And they are liberating this territory from the United States. And people need to understand what this movement is.
William Jacobs, and we're going to talk more about this in the future. Cornell Law Professor, LegalInsurrection.com. I appreciate you. More is coming up. I'm Tony Katz.
Hi, I'm Dean Alex Trianis, and I use the pronouns he and him. At Carey Business School, we strongly support the principles of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. We want our school to be a place where everyone feels welcome and a part of our community. And we want our graduates to emulate these ideals in society.
I don't think I'll come to the point where I'm hiring people from the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School. I just want you all to know that if I do, I won't be hiring from the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School because they aren't actually interested in business. And the idea that you would be supportive of bigotry and supportive of demonizing the soul and damaging the mind as a value, I'll pass. Thank you. Thank you there, Dean. Appreciate you letting us know. I always like a good warning. Hiring graduates from this business school will be damaging to your business. And also, these people are probably pretty sad. Just my take. I'm Tony Katz.